I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. Has Jewish power peaked? That's the question we're going to deal with today. We're going to talk about the Gaza crisis and the world's reaction to it, and also broader trends that are going on. Before we get into that, though, I want to point out that Countercurrents is doing a fundraiser. We have currently a matching grant for first-time donors. I think there's about $400 left on that matching grant. So if you have not donated before and want to do it for the first time, do it now and it'll be doubled. Go to Entropy, entropystream.live/countercurrents. That's without the hyphen, countercurrents. Hit the green button and haul out your credit card and leave a donation. We very much appreciate it. We can also take donations through Cash App, and we can take your tips through Odyssey, and we will even take those tokens on DLive, the diamonds, lemons, ninjets, ninjaginis. We will cash those in at the end of the year and apply them to our fundraiser goal. So thank you very much for doing that. I want to thank especially Entropy that stayed with us. They were the sole people that would allow you to use credit cards to send money to Countercurrents for a very long time after we were blacklisted from the global credit card processing industry. So they deserve a big thanks. So thank you, Entropy. I want to welcome two friends, Morgoth and Endeavor. Morgoth, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me back on there, Greg. You just caught me out. I was just busy giving it another shill on Twitter there. It's nice to be back on. Thanks for the invite.
Yeah, it's always great to talk. And Endeavor, welcome back.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. I always enjoy these streams.
So there are big things going on in the world. It's an exciting time to be alive. This Gaza crisis has been going on for weeks now. And we've all been watching in awe, in shock and awe, not so much at the cruelty that's being rained down on Gaza by the Israelis, but at their very public nervous breakdowns. And I don't mean just Israelis, but Jews more generally. They're having very public nervous breakdowns. They're engaged in transparently manipulative behavior, the "would you hide me" campaign, wearing yellow stars to the UN and things like that. They don't seem to be able to control this. I think it's terrible optics. And I'm seeing a lot of pushback where I never would have seen pushback before. I'm seeing questions where in the past would have been just dull agreement. I'm seeing polls that indicate that if you get up into the baby boom generation, 80% of them in America stand by Israel. And if you get down into the Zoomers, it's like 30% stand by Israel in this crisis. And with each generational cohort from boomers to Zoomers, it drops appreciably. That's very, very interesting. And I'm seeing pushback, not just in our sphere, although in our sphere, I think it's been superb, but I'm seeing broader pushback against this. This is very, very encouraging. And I wanted to bring you guys on because you've been in the trenches, both battling and commenting on what's happening, and just get your takes on it because I value your thoughts. So guys, do you think Jewish power may be peaking? Morgoth, you want to begin?
Yeah, I do think it has. I read the article Endeavor did, which I'm sure he'll touch on, about Dr. Goldenstein's,
Dr. Goldenstein's monster.
Well, the gist of that is kind of my take as well. And I've seen some other people having the view that it is the woke putting the Zionism away, which I think is an interesting kind of thing to dig into, where these things which they in part, not wholly, I've got a mind on the British hate speech laws here, which they help to foster. That it's kind of spiraled out of their control. And I think there's something to that. I think that they ended up being one of many different client groups or special interest groups. Whereas if you go back to the 90s, I would say, when Jewish power or influence or that sort of sacredness that they had, that halo, I would say it was around about the peak then. I'm thinking of something like Schindler's List coming out and having an impact on the culture and this kind of thing. And I think it's had its ups and downs since then, and I think it's relative to then, it's like at bottom now. And how what I mean by that is that they had a sort of special aura. There was a kind of off-limits thing about everything which was related to them, which is gone. And I think they're in this sort of position of diminishing returns where the Holocaust card and it gets played and it doesn't have the impact anymore. So they've got to lay it on, really think. I mean, obviously, the gold stars at the United Nations is a perfect example of it. And just in the general tone and pitch is hysterical, which I think doesn't do them any favours. But at the end of the day, what's happened, in my view, is that they've become just another group. Whereas if you go back a few years, we had the summer of Floyd, you had Black Lives Matter, they were a special group with their own special problems, and we all had to, you know, get on board with that. And then you have the transsexual stuff more recently. And I think people just see Jews as being just another one of those groups, except whiter and richer and more connected to the American deep state as the Holocaust sort of dwindles in the mind, in the memories of people. I mean, that's my general view of what's happened here. We can sort of dig it in, but I'll hand it over to Endeavor for now.
Well, I wrote an article about this last week. So what I used as kind of the basis of the article was the story of Frankenstein, Mary Shelley's novel of Frankenstein. Everyone, I'm pretty sure, knows the story. Dr. Frankenstein's this scientist who creates this, he reanimates a corpse and brings his dead body back to life. And then it turns into a disaster. He creates this abomination. And then the monster of his own creation basically destroys everything that he loves and turns his life into hell. And I was reminded of this when seeing the back and forth between the pro-Israel and the pro-Palestine camps in the last couple of weeks since the beginning of the crisis in Gaza. Because it's important to note who's really on each of these sides. It's important to note that two sides of this divide, neither of them are allies of ours. They are both anti-white. But the divide is really over whether or not Israel gets an exception to the universalist egalitarian values of globalism. And ironically, the values that the organized Jewish community has played a bigger role than any in propagating in the West and then around the world as well. You know, when you think of who comprises this kind of upstart pro-Palestine movement, you have white leftists. And remember, these are not allies of ours. Basically, they incorrectly view Jews as white. And they are true believers in this, you know, universalist egalitarian worldview. You have Muslims who are now, there are a lot of them in the West, and they're just basically just out for their own ethnic and religious interests. And then you have a bunch of other non-whites, people like Black Lives Matter. And with them, they've been told that they're the biggest victim group. So Morgoth mentioned that Schindler's List was this huge movie back in the 1990s. Now, it came out a couple of years before I was born. The biggest pieces of propaganda in my lifetime were things like Django Unchained or 12 Years a Slave or Get Out. These things focus around blacks a lot more than they did around Jews. So I feel like the ultimate victim class has kind of been shifted away from them. And what they see right now is there's this big kind of the anti-white coalition, which, I mean, they are in many ways the architects of, has kind of gotten out of their control and in some ways turned against them. In that, what I referred to in the article, what Kevin MacDonald calls the culture of critique, they push these ideas as this Machiavellian way of breaking apart white ethnocentrism and while maintaining Jewish ethnocentrism and transferring power in the West from whites to Jews. Now it feels like that monster that they've created is coming back and devouring themselves. And they're kind of in the situation where they no longer have that special status. They no longer have the exemption from the poison that they have played a large part in spreading.
It's like poison gas. So one of the reasons why people stopped using poison gas is you'd lob a few canisters of poison gas at your enemy's trenches, and then the wind would blow the poison gas back onto your people, and they would die as well. And you know, it's such a cliche. It's a great globalist cliche. We live in a small, densely interconnected world, right? You can't just lob canisters of poison gas, mimetic poison gas around, and expect it not to blow back to your own people. We live in too small a world for that to happen now. There are a lot of ways that you could argue, I think, that Jewish power has peaked. I was sort of taking notes on this today. First of all, you can make a very broad deductive argument. Nothing lasts forever. Everything peaks and declines. And therefore, one of these days, Jewish power is going to get to its zenith and start declining. So it's inevitable that it's going to happen. The only question is it happening now? One of the great sources of Jewish power is centralization. Their numbers are tiny. So the more centralized power is, and the closer they are to those centers of power, the greater the power they have, which means that if there is decentralization going on, that weakens them. And the great form of decentralization that's happened over the past couple of decades is the internet and social media, as opposed to the old-fashioned media. Those have caused a decline of their power because they have decentralized communication and made it possible for people to express ideas that they didn't create and can't fully control. So that's definitely one reason to think that their power has been declining for decades now. Jewish power is largely parasitic on American power right now, especially when you talk about killing power and pushing people around power, the power to intimidate, the power to kill, the power to starve with sanctions and things like that, which ultimately is backed up by killing force too. The enforcer of that, the world police, for a long time has been the United States. And the decline of American power means the decline of Jewish power, as long as Jewish power is parasitic on American power. And I think it's unquestionable that American power is declining. And therefore, I think you can conclude from that that Jewish power has to be declining. But then if you want to look at the evidence from Gaza, there's another thing before we get into that, which is just demographics. The West is becoming less white. Non-whites are less susceptible to Jewish manipulation than whites. And that's very important. The West is becoming more Islamized, and more broadly you can say less Christian, and therefore Muslims and non-Christians in general are less susceptible, I think, to Jewish manipulation. And so those trends are militating against Jewish power. But then you get to the recent evidence from Gaza. I just think that they're blowing it very badly because they're out of control, and their reaction is out of control. They're behaving as if they live in the world where there are three major television networks and a few major news sources, and, you know, that the newspapers are controlled by news agencies, and there are a few centralized sources of information that they control, and therefore they can act arrogantly with essential impunity because they feel like they can simply write the narrative when it's all done or control it even when it's unfolding. And that hasn't been true for the better part of a generation now. But you know, we're ruled by people who are older than average, and their minds are still formed by the time when they had that centralized control. So that I think is, you know, a weakness that they've got. And the behavior is absolutely barbarous and cruel, and they can't hide it. So I think this is very encouraging.
Just a note on the information side. I remember when it was just a day or two after this sort of thing kicked off, one of the top bureaucrats from the European Union had a back and forth with Elon Musk on Twitter, and he was kind of blackmailing Elon Musk because the European Union have got their own sort of online harms bill, the sort of technocratic control thing, working its way through the various departments, which will eventually become law next year, the same as ours. And Australia's got one as well. But just, I thought it was very interesting because it was just a few days into the Gaza crisis, Thierry something or other had this back and forth with Elon Musk, and it was blackmail. It was like, you will get this under control, you will get this sorted out. And Musk, he didn't seem to take that very seriously. He didn't change. He certainly didn't censor any more than what he was doing beforehand. And on top of that, you also, which is a new phenomenon, which I find is interesting, you get these Twitter spaces, which get massive audiences, much more than the mainstream media. And they've got this thing where they are obsessive about being objective and factual and truthful, so much so that if something counters something they've said, they'll immediately retract it because they know they've got the European Union watching them like hawks. And so what's happened is there's this new format. One of the big ones, I listened to a lot of it. It was a few days in, and it had like 8 million views or something. You know, Tucker Carlson gets huge numbers on there. And so you've got this new way, which isn't controlled by friendlies, as they would see it. And I just thought it was interesting that the European Union knew that. They were looking ahead and thinking, we can't get a grasp on the information that's going out there. We've lost a node in the network here. And that little back and forth with Elon Musk, who I've got my own doubts about in relation to the technology and whatnot. But at least in this case, it was like, well, we're gonna sort of present this as truthfully as we possibly can. And they have actually done that on all of these huge spaces. And it's like, well, this is one of those times where they've lost control of that sort of that grip that they had on information. So that's also added to a problem. As you were saying, in the old days, if you think of the Iraq war and these kinds of things, the war on terror, they had a much tighter grip on the information. And it's not just the news itself, but the spin that somebody like Bill O'Reilly would give. Whereas now you've got these sort of obsessively objective bugmen, often with Arabic names, funny enough, or you know, from around these tech bros, and they're trying to present all of this information genuinely as truthfully as they can because they're realizing. And I think that's a new interesting development.
This actually isn't even the first, well, bloody nose that the organized Jewish community has been given in the last year. So remember, before the crisis in Palestine kicked off, there was that big campaign on Twitter, which people like Keith Woods and a lot of our guys got involved in, the Ban the ADL campaign. And then the year prior, towards the end of the year, there was the Kanye West fiasco. Now, I know that turned out to be a bit of a joke. And, you know, I think that they were on the back foot, but then eventually I think they got the better of Kanye because he did really mess up the opportunity he had in that regard. But the way that they came down on Musk, because Musk is not, he's not our guy, let's just say. Like, Musk is not, it doesn't seem to be somebody who is strongly opposed to the organized Jewish community in any real sense. But they really came down hard on Musk, not for any views that he has, but the idea that just the possibility that somebody on his platform might be allowed to express views that they don't agree with. You know, they really started to come across as these, well, as kind of these crybabies online who are dictating what people are allowed to say on the internet. And they don't really have that same moral backing that they would have had in decades past. You know, in the past, it would have been, well, people would have sided with them that, well, this person's this horrible anti-Semite. He can't possibly be allowed to be on TV because, well, last time some anti-Semite was allowed to speak his views, then 6 million or 6 billion Jewish people died. But with the whole back and forth with Musk over the last year, and then culminating in this Ban the ADL campaign, which, you know, Musk, I don't know if he actually, I mean, he didn't end up actually banning them, but, you know, he would actually reply to some of the tweets. It definitely caught his eye. The entire time, it just feels like These people are just desperately trying to control what people are allowed to say on the internet. And it shows it, they do just kind of look like tyrants now. They don't have the moral high ground now. They just look like people who want to tell everyone what they're not allowed to say.
They're the most powerful group in the world, and they're behaving like they're victims and demanding that we pity them and therefore do what they tell us to do. And it's laughable. It's gotten to the point where it's actually doesn't pass the laugh test. And I think people who are closer and closer to the normie center are capable of seeing that. I do think it's important to talk about big historical trends, like, okay, everything declines. Decentralization through technology is happening. American power is declining. Demographics are changing. These are big macro trends, but history also involves individuals. And honestly, the most valuable individual in the world today is Elon Musk, in my opinion, because he's created a relatively free speech bubble where there wasn't one before, and that's on Twitter. And one could argue that perhaps things are not going well for Jewish power right now because Elon's running Twitter. And if he hadn't bought Twitter, things might be going very, very differently. I still think they would be facing challenges that they hadn't faced before. But obviously what Elon Musk has done at Twitter, I think, has created a space where a lot more freedom of thought and a lot more red pilling is taking place. So yes, he's tremendously important. And I do agree, it's important to point out that the Ban the ADL campaign, and we have to give our thanks to people like Keith Woods, softened things up, paved the way for this. Definitely. People were paying attention to this, and indeed with Kanye as well. I just want to pause here, though, to welcome Pox Populi. He's dropping in as a surprise. Pox, welcome.
Hello, everyone. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, hello, I can hear you fine.
All right, good to be here. Sorry for the late arrival, but there was no way getting around it.
Well, what are your thoughts on this? Do you think their power is peaking?
Well, I'll try and give the perspective of the glass being half full, and then my honest perspective, which is usually that of the party pooper Pox. But I do think that it seems... At least it seems to my eye that there is a moment of no return. Like we've reached a moment of no return for the broader Holocaust narrative or Israeli 100% unconditional support for Israel narrative. I think that Israel in particular, and then it, as an extension, Jews in general, have lost a bit of goodwill. And I don't know if they'll get that back. Even on Twitter that I heard you guys talking about, there's been a lot of pushback, even to Jewish figures who were more or less anti-woke, sympathetic with anti-immigration sentiments. I'm thinking specifically of Gad Saad. And in all of his posts, he's been getting a lot of pushback, and not a lot of people are buying what he's selling anymore. And in particular, he recently put up a poll, and the question was, are Israelis bombing Gaza because Jews are genocidal or because it's a response to the October 7th terrorist attack? And the winning result, which was winning by a huge margin at the beginning, but at the end won by a smaller margin, but still won, was that Jews are genocidal. And in the responses, everyone was citing several examples going back throughout history. I think the internet has become a sort of Pandora's box. Obviously, in the early days of the internet, the facts, you know, revisionist history of the Second World War, honest conversations about the JQ, those are being held in the dark corners of the internet. Now it's everywhere on the internet. And I think the powers that be have really noticed that going, you know, back a few years, and they've been trying to censor it. But Pandora's box is opened. There's no putting the spirits back inside. And so that's positive. And I do think that, yeah, like you guys were saying, there's accounts with massive followings that aren't particularly, you know, right wing or left wing. And they're not particularly white either in some cases. But they have a huge following, and they are exposing in particular, they're exposing the Jewish hypocrisy. They're exposing the Israeli hypocrisy. And I think that's what's proving to be most distasteful for a huge number of people that are looking on. At the same time, the glass less full perspective is that I remember the years of COVID, which you could argue we're still in, and I remember how short people's memories were, and I remember how people could see things in front of them with their own eyes, and yet still their ideology or the narrative would overpower them. And even though they were seeing things in front of them themselves with their own eyes, they would still go along with what the narrative was telling them, which was the opposite of what they were seeing. And so I wouldn't be surprised if, even though there is all of this hypocrisy and these terrible images, you know, of children blown to bits being posted online, and there's never been more widespread, uncontrollable anti-Israel sentiment, I do think that for a lot of people, particularly like, you know, boomer evangelical Americans, you could tell them on a Monday these things and they will agree with you. And then on a Tuesday, you'll see them back on Facebook posting their 100% unconditional support for Israel. So that's something to take into account. Also, there was this discussion on our side of things over the past couple of months, whether or not the powers that be were going to put the woke away. And some were even thinking that this whole thing with war in the Middle East and, you know, threatening to swell into a world war would be another step in the direction of the woke being put away, because there's just more serious things to deal with now. But I don't know what you guys think, but I'm seeing that it looks like the woke is going to put Zionism away. Obviously, there's an anti-Zionist Jewish coterie. And then the way that the pro-Palestinian leftists and the non-white pro-Palestinians, the way that they're framing this is that Israel is a white colonizer oppressor, and that Israeli nationalism is just as bad as any form of European nationalism. And so they're going to put Israeli nationalism away too, just like they've pretty much, you know, put white nationalism or European nationalism away. So I always say that the system is very resilient. It knows how to absorb so many body blows that you think would be a KO and then just withstand them and come back even stronger sometimes. So I think that's something to take into account, and I'll leave it there.
I think at this point we could kind of pause, like dig into a little bit of the, let's say, the left and the right. Because I think it's certainly the case that something's gone wrong for the Zionist camp with this particular crisis. If we say that they've got a problem with woke, and I would agree with that. And I think it's interesting to look at what exactly we mean by woke, because I would say that would be the ideology of the managerial classes in the Western world, the managerial bureaucracy of the West, with a lot of powerful and very powerful institutions on their side, is kind of like what constitutes woke in the West. And so if you say the summer of Floyd or COVID would be a big one, they were all, that class of people were all fully signed up to that. And that's why it became this like unstoppable, crazy stuff. And there's been other ones as well. And in this instance, the problem they've got is that that's the very class which they don't seem to have on side. And so when you then you have a look, so what are they falling back on? You can see that there's now this desperate sort of trying to shore up support from the right. And I think that's problematic as well. And I would actually say we've got to doff the cap to people in our circles, the people who leave comments, the people who've got small Twitter accounts, who ceaselessly just drop the odd red-pilling comment or tweet, whatever it is, all over the internet day in, day out, and have done for a long time now. Because if you've got a platform like I have or we have here, and you've got you see the comments, it's always like that, even when it's on like friendly territory. But they're also doing that under pop videos, under cultural commentary, you know, movie critic, YouTube, it's everywhere. It's absolutely everywhere. It's this thing where if you are I would say, from being a kind of right-leaning classic liberal all the way over to the sort of whatever, a spicy group chat on Telegram or whatever it would be in the online space. That whole swathe is dominated by people dropping red pills and mentioning them in little brackets and all of this kind of thing. And I think what that's done is gradually gnawed away at the support that they'd have on the right. So it's one thing to say they've got big problems on the left with the managerial sort of politically correct ESG and all of that. So then they fall back on the right, but they find that their support on the right has been kind of eaten away. It's been like acid or something has just kind of gnawed away at it. And what I see now is this sort of desperate, frantic return of the old counter-jihad types. And another problem is that it's kind of a bit uncool. It seems dated. It seems old. And it seems as if like they're out of date. It's like something from a bygone era. And it's just not trendy. It's not high status to kind of get in on Zionism. And you see this because, I mean, I'll get into this more with people like Douglas Murray when everybody's had their say. But we've got big protests planned in Britain. There's all kinds of things happening to do with the cenotaph next week, and it's again the old sort of, you know, the old bulldog nationalists are expected to turn up and get pummeled once again. Because that, I mean, I'll come into that. It's a slightly different subject. I'll come back to that. What I wanted to just say here is that when we look at the forces lined up on each side, one of the problems is that the kind of politically correct managerial sort of cogs of the system of the West are what they're having problems with. Except when you go right to the top, of course, and you've still got the politicians themselves are by and large mainly like that. But in Britain, you look at the foreigners who run our country and the British deep state, they have, of course, backed up Israel. But the problem is, because they are at the top, then you've got all of the bureaucracy under them is not going along with it so much. So they haven't to find ways, once again, to appeal to the people that they hate, to the people who they've dispossessed and slandered and done nothing and betrayed and backstabbed. So that, I think, is the general lineup of the sort of the paradigm here, what we're talking about, these different forces.
I think it's important for us to look at power as a zero-sum game. So, you know, there is a finite amount of power that can be held. By one group holding it, another group is not holding it. But it's also important for us to remember that there's several different factions out there. So, you know, despite what a certain someone on Telegram with a Third Reich-inspired pseudonym and a Palestinian flag in his bio, who I'm not going to mention here, despite what he might tell you, there are multiple factions who are up against here. So we have the woke left, which Morgoth was mentioning, kind of the managerial ruling class ideology, and then you have Zionism. When there's this overlap between the two, but there's this big contradiction now that Israel is a glaring contradiction to the woke values, because it doesn't fit in with the ideology that is supposedly meant to be for the entire world. It's supposed to be universalist. I think that a much larger portion of the power that has been taken away from the Israel Zionist lobby has been consolidated among the woke managerial class, and which is equally as anti-white. So it's important for us not to get too far ahead of ourselves, because while Jewish power might be declining, that doesn't mean that what is stepping in to take its place is any more preferable. It's actually, I'd say, equally as bad. However, on the right, I would say that we have taken away a smaller chunk, but there still has been ground that has been gained in that regard. And it's like things that Morgoth was mentioning, that when someone like Jordan Peterson or someone like that comes out full bore on support of Israel, you just see in their comment sections that they're just getting absolutely massacred. Like, if you know that Visegrad 24 group on Twitter, it's supposed to be this site that's based around the Visegrad countries in Central Europe. Yet for the last like 3 or 4 weeks, it's been tweeting nonstop about Israel. and they're just absolutely getting killed in all their comment sections. So
yeah, you know, that was obviously some kind of, you know, Zionist setup or,
yes,
or
exactly.
cutout group, and they smoked themselves out. I thought that was really fascinating. They couldn't help themselves. They couldn't maintain their cover.
Yeah, and so I feel that in the whole like zero sum game of power, a big chunk has been taken away from the Zionist lobby and gone towards the woke managerial class. And then a smaller chunk from the right has been taken away by us. But that's still something that's still something we can take pride in. That's still a positive development.
I agree. And one thing I think we have to do is we have to do everything that we can to deny the Jewish led establishment the right wing foot soldiers that they're trying to whip up. We have to deny them that. And coming out against these, you know, a march and the stuff that Douglas Murray's promoting, I think, is extremely important. We cannot, to whatever extent we have any power, we can't let these people do that. And I do think that people like Douglas Murray and Jordan Peterson, they don't have the credibility they had even a few months ago because of this. And I think that that's the work of our guys, and we have to congratulate ourselves, broadly speaking, for that. Yet at the same time, there's something happening here that I think is extremely important and extremely encouraging. We are now hearing the center right using the D word, the deportation word. We are now hearing the center right bemoaning multiculturalism and talking about how it doesn't work and talking about sending some of these people back. And I find this extremely encouraging. Yes, they're talking about sending people back for entirely the wrong reasons, but they're still talking about it. And I would like to talk about the ethics of that. I'd like to talk about how we need to exploit this. My basic view about this is this: Muslims and Jews in the diaspora have been partners for a very long time. They have been allies for a very long time against things like white supremacism, against us, against white people, against normatively white societies with white majorities and white histories. They have been allies, and now they have fallen out. To the extent that they have fallen out, both camps are weaker. And if Jews are trying to whip up the center right into supporting deportation of Muslim radical types, I think that would be good for us. I think that would mean that there will be fewer schoolgirls groomed. I think that means there will be fewer nail bombs going off in white countries. There will be less rape, less murder, less terrorism, and less demographic decline. And white people might get addicted to that, and they might start wanting more. And this could be a game changer. This could turn the tide. And I think, therefore, that we should figure out a way that we can say yes for deportation. No, we're not going to be foot soldiers for your wars, but yes, we are for this. And I think that the counter argument that's heard in our circles, namely, no, we shouldn't do this because this strengthens Jews, I don't think that's true. Jews were stronger before they had a falling out with the Muslims over Gaza. If Jews in their frenzy end up deporting some of their erstwhile allies, when Gaza dies down and this crisis dies down and things go back to a greater semblance of normality, they will not have these allies that they used to have to fight against white supremacy. That will weaken them against us. So what are your thoughts about this, guys?
Well, I think it's also another opportunity to drive home Jewish hypocrisy, because when one of these center-right figures says we need to deport these Palestine supporters that are rallying in London or wherever it is, I think the response is to say, I agree with you, but why is it that they only became a problem when Jews started to have a problem with them? you know, all of the years from now that they've been terrorizing the native white populations, why wasn't that good enough reason to deport them then? So, you know, absolutely. it is a good way to like lead into that. There's this great example from a few years ago that there was this Algerian migrant in, I think it was France, and he was deported from France for refusing to deliver food to a Jewish customer. And, you know, this was, is just a perfect example, because it's an example where you can say, well, you know, they won't deport Algerian migrants for rioting, for committing rape or murder or terrorism, but then being slightly rude to a Jewish person will get them deported. So, you know, this is just this thing on the same, on a bigger scale. You could just lean into it and say, well, why isn't it that this conversation was started earlier?
Why is it that Jews are sacrosanct in France, but not the French? Why is it that Jews are sacrosanct in England, but not the English? That's a very, very salient question that they're setting themselves up for, and our guys are posing it constantly. And I think this is a great opportunity.
Yeah, it did infuriate me that this newly minted neocon sort of right wing, which is a bit of a shambles because they're taking on rules and talking points they're not particularly familiar with or used to. Again, it's not sort of Bill O'Reilly on Fox News in 2007 or something. But it did infuriate me. It did infuriate me that all of the horrors and the miseries that have been inflicted on, and, you know, the British and Europeans in general, but the British in particular for me, I've read the court reports of the grooming gangs. I know how horrible that was. I knew that I put this on Twitter that it read like something like from the Eastern Front, and it's like, what, that doesn't matter. And my message to these people is, which I've said again and again, is that I refuse to accept, whether it's to the left, and it's the life of a Palestinian or a Muslim, or the life of a Jew, I don't accept that they are worth more than an English girl from an unfashionable town somewhere in the post-industrial north. I just will not accept those conditions. On the issue of deportation, I actually did a couple of polls today. So I asked the question, would you support mass deportations for groups deemed anti-Semitic and only those groups? So the idea was, it was to sort of ruffle a few feathers and catch some people off guard, and we can get into that. And on Telegram, only 16% said yes. So Telegram's going to be a lot more, let's say, spicy and edgy bro than what Twitter will be. It certainly seems like it. So only 16% of the people who follow me on Telegram would be willing to deport people for anti-Semitism. Now, I get it. It's the big lie, of course. And then on Twitter, that was different. On Twitter, I put, could you live with mass deportations of non-natives only for being anti-Semitic? And on Twitter, 56%, there was 3,464. Again, thanks to Elon for the free speech, by the way. But there was 3,464, as I took the screenshot anyway. And 56% said yes, 17% said no. And then 27% said, for not knowing. And so what we see there is an interesting disparity between Telegram and Twitter, all of which would have been our guys. But it raises the question, because it's what is it? It gets back to sort of, what is it that we want to do? And there was all kinds of replies underneath. And there was all kinds of, well, there would be this or that contingent or that contingent. But as Greg was saying, the immediate sort of the knife would be removed from our throats and give us a bit of breathing time. Of course, this is all hypothetical, and it's, you know, you can kind of bandy around. But what I wanted to get at here would be that, in a way, it would be living the big lie. I mean, I said to Greg earlier today, it reminded me of Watchmen, where the plot of Watchmen is where the Ozymandias sets up Dr. Manhattan. So it looks like Dr. Manhattan has set off nukes. He actually hasn't. And nukes will go off, but then the world will unite and blame Dr. Manhattan. and they'll come together. It will be peace, but it will be based on a lie. And of course, Rorschach, which reminds me of Greg's review of this, actually, why he said he didn't like people like Rorschach. Rorschach refuses. He can't go along with the big lie for purely sort of utilitarian or pragmatic reasons. The truth, the great truth, the great lie must be exposed, even if it means more misery in the world. And that's why I actually put that poll Weigart, because I thought it was an interesting question to chuck into our circles.
Pox, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I'll first say that I understand and I appreciate the view that if we lean into Jews in Europe, Jews in the United States, you know, the dual citizens in the United States, bigging up deportation rhetoric and actually even carrying it out, like, I'll believe it when I see it, first of all. But yeah, we have all these politicians, you know, Olaf Scholz in Germany is now saying we need to engage in mass deportations of these anti-Semites. The rhetoric is heating up in Britain. And so, yeah, it might happen. But I appreciate the concern that in doing so, it basically is a consecration of the idea that Jewish lives matter more, that the value of Jewish lives is superior to the value of everyone else's lives. And that's including the native population, which we all know has been ignored, not even ignored, completely insulted. We get told to don't look back in anger when our people are abused or slaughtered. We are told not to have hate in our hearts and not to blame any race or religion, even though it's very clear which races and which religions have been abusing us. So I understand that. I fully understand that. But I just think that, look, Jews were massively and disproportionately involved in bringing these people here in the first place. And one of the reasons, not the only reason, but one of the reasons why not all the Jews, but some of the Jews who worked to bring these people here is because they aren't very nice. It's precisely because they're like human ticking time bombs. It's precisely because they have 8 children and are going to outbreed us. There is a famous French rabbi. His last name is Tutot. I believe I'm pronouncing it correctly. And I think his first name is Ravi. It's like Rabbi Revi. It's kind of strange. But he famously said, I'm sure people have seen the clips of him, you know, giving his sermons or whatever you call it when a Jew has a service in the synagogue. And he called Islam the broom that would sweep away Europe as punishment for Europeans' sins against the Jews. So we know that. Now, if Jews who brought these people here, and if now other Jews want to say, well, let's get rid of them, I'm fine with leaning into that. But we have to keep pushing home our talking point, which is, why was it not important years ago when we were getting slaughtered in Bataclan theaters and on the Promenade des Anglais in Nice, and our women were being raped inside of alleys and outside train stations, and, you know, over a thousand German women were assaulted by Maghrebi and sub-Saharan Africans on one night on New Year's Eve? Why wasn't it important then? And if anti-Semitism is going to be the only reason, well, we need to add more reasons to that list. So we need to lean into this. So while I appreciate the perspective that deporting anti-Semitic brown Muslims who support Palestine, blah, 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 are waving, you know, various flags or saying various anti-Semitic slogans, quote unquote, anti-Semitic slogans, I appreciate that that is basically consecrating Jewish lives. But at the same time, I do want these people out of my country, out of our countries. And I don't think it's right to do what some people have been doing, which is to say that anyone who is leaning into this is a Zionist shill or is a secret Jew. There's a whole swathe of Spurgs who are doing that. And it's not productive. It's not constructive. It's not helpful. We can chew gum at the same time as you posted a few weeks ago, Greg. So that's one thing there. We have to also remember that, like I said earlier, the Palestinian people, the pro-Palestinian people, you know, particularly the non-white, non-leftist types, or even just, you know, types like we mentioned, Keith Woods, who are taking up the Palestinian cause. The ones who are really far left and the ones who are non-white, who have skin in the game, literally, again, they are framing Israel as a white colonizer oppressor. And they are holding up signs saying, you know, dumb white dogs, get out of Gaza. So that's something to take into account. Like, I don't think that we're ever going to get these people on our side and, you know, take on Jewish power. And then even if that did happen, they're not going to leave. Like, if we work together and take on the Jays and somehow get rid of them, the Arab Muslims, the Afghan Muslims, the sub-Saharan Africans, they're not going to say, oh, well, it was great working together, guys. Now we're all going to go to our countries now. No. There is a Muslim on Twitter. He's British. He lives in Britain. His name is Dili Hussein. Perhaps Morgoth will know of him, be familiar with him. Dili Hussein. He was going on several days in a row talking about how, you know, Muslims belong in Britain. Britain is their country now, while everyone else is busy with their lives. Muslims are growing in number. They are taking up positions of power, leading communities, becoming politicians. And then after he'd spent a few days doing that, when Douglas Murray called him out on Twitter, adding him, because he had, I think, said, you know, from the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free, which is now being considered an anti-Semitic war cry or something. So Douglas Murray called him out for saying that or something else. And he also tagged the Met police. And he said, what is this man doing in our country? And Dili Hussein responded with just one word, multiplying. So, like, I want these people gone. And I don't care if it's for the wrong reasons right now. I will lean into that, but fully understanding that, and this is what I've been saying, like Morgoth mentioned, how we are just completely spamming the comments of all of these, you know, neocons and Zionists. And one thing I keep spamming people like Douglas Murray and Jordan Peterson before he blocked me, Ben Shapiro, etc., is why do Jewish feelings matter more than European lives? Because again, we've been getting raped, murdered, and slaughtered for years because of these people. And now Jews just feel unsafe. And we're talking about deportations. Why is it that Jewish feelings are so much more important than our very own lives? Yeah. But maintaining that position, I'm also happy with chewing gum at the same time and leaning into getting these people out.
Another thing that you can do is, because I mean, I'd be over the moon if they said tomorrow that they're going to deport all these Muslims from Europe and North America, albeit for the wrong reasons. I would be more than happy to accept that. I am a bit skeptical whether that'll actually happen, but just the fact that it's being talked about is a good thing. Another thing that I think we can do is try to get the organized Jewish community, the censorship industrial complex which they've built, try to get that turned away from us and turned towards these anti-white third worldists. Because, like, let's say an example I gave in my article is, let's say you're a student at university and then the Black Lives Matter chapter is doing this pro-Palestine march or something. Go report them to your university's Jewish group, and then maybe, who knows, they'll get, may even get the ADL involved. And what that would be doing is, you're either A, wasting the resources of Jewish power and their censorship industrial complex, you're taking the time and resources that they usually spend on shutting down us and getting that and putting that towards these other groups. And the other benefit is that, who knows, maybe even some of these student groups might even get banned. Now, again, it's for the wrong reasons, but, you know, if you can get some anti-white BLM third worldist, you know, kicked out of their positions of power at your university, for example, I think that's something worth doing, you know, getting them to fight each other. Because, you know, it's important to note that neither of these two sides are our sides. They're both our enemies. And it's important to remind people on the right, because so much of our talking points have gone towards the JQ and for good reason. But it's important to remind people that the fundamental problem with the Jewish question is that it's us being dominated by foreigners, by some, it's white European civilization being dominated by people who are not white Europeans and don't share our interests. That is also true for Muslims. That is also true for Africans. That's also true for all these other groups. So we want to restore our own rule. And it's important to note that neither of these sides are our friends. So it's best to play them against each other.
That's it. We have to be Machiavellian. We have to realpolitik here. And for once, we have to be clever and ruthless about these things and not just content ourselves with spicy memes and, the occasional, celebratory ratio on Twitter. Let's be serious about this. And Morgoth mentioned a film. I'll reference a film here. I did this in the wake of the attack and all of the fallout. But there's that scene in Braveheart where Robert the Bruce gets wind of William Wallace's rebellion, and he's very excited about it, and he finds William to be very inspiring and idealistic. So he goes to see his dying father, who is a very important Scottish noble. And, he talks to his father about how inspiring William Wallace is. And the wiser Bruce tells his son, "You will embrace Wallace's rebellion and gain favor with him and the nobles who are siding with him. I will gain English favor by siding with the English and condemning the rebellion. And thus I will pave the way for you by clearing out both of your enemies on either side of this new war that's kicking off. I will pave the way for you to the throne." That is how a political mastermind thinks. He's ruthless. Exactly. He's ruthless. We need to be ruthless. We're not taking anyone's side. We're not secret Jews or Zio shills or third worldist brown people lovers. We are taking our own side, but playing the other sides to our advantage. So please, can we all just stop with the ankle biting and the retardation and get on the same page with this?
Absolutely. Back in 2001, it was a little more than a week after September 11th, 2001, I flew to Paris and I went to the Fête de Bleu Blanc Rouge at the National Front. And I was there with a number of Americans, and I also met up with a number of Englishmen, Anglophone nationalists who came across the channel. And we had to get together in a hotel. And of course, September 11th was the big topic because it was so recent. And there was an interesting division. The Americans wanted to talk about Jews and hammer away on the Jewish angle. Whereas a number of these Britons wanted to talk about the Muslim angle. There were a couple of guys who I talked to who were working class guys. They worked in a factory. And they said that in their factory, when the news came out of the attack on the Twin Towers, the Muslims who were working there were hooping it up. And that this really bothered them. And I thought, well, I can understand that. And the debate got a little heated. And then I realized, wait a second here, let's just stand back here. Can white people really lose if the conversation we're having is, are the Muslims worse or the Jews worse? No matter which side in that conversation, quote unquote, wins, it's still good for white people. And so I thought, we don't need to get so heated about this. In fact, let's take a page from the book of Genesis. When Jacob and Esau had fallen out and Jacob saw his half-brother's people moving into the area where he was grazing his flocks, and he felt threatened by this. He thought, is he going to attack or not? What did he do? He divided his camp into two, and he sent some of his people to his half-brother as defectors to join the enemy camp. And they could spy for him and represent his interests. And if he were attacked and killed, some of his people would survive in the other camp. It's a completely Machiavellian move. And there's no reason why we can't divide our camp and say, okay, it really floats my boat to emphasize the Jewish angle. Well, it floats my boat to emphasize the Muslim angle. And let's see if we can change the parameters of the broader debate in society to who's worse for white people. Because if we can change the debate that way, we've won. And this is how the enemy works. This is how they dominate us. They frame all debates in the broader political society so that no matter who, quote unquote, wins, their interests are okay. And I don't see any reason why we can't be that Machiavellian and try and aim for that kind of hegemony, that kind of soft power through reframing debates around, you know, the underlying assumption is what's best for white people. And you could argue one principle or, you know, one side or the other, but as if the underlying assumption is what's best for us, we've won. So I think we shouldn't, in our own camp, get too angry with one another or get too out of joint with disagreement, because as long as people go out there and red pill people, see the broader public with our memes and ideas and get this debate widened, that's not a bad thing for us. And so, yeah, I do think we need to be somewhat Machiavellian about this. We need to not lose sight of our own interests and our own perspective. And that's the danger here. I wrote a piece years ago about this, about not losing our own point of view in these debates, because people want to force us into one or the other. There was that propaganda film, The Innocence of Muslims. And I wrote a piece called something like The Innocence of Muslims, The Something of Jews and the Interests of Whites, trying to say, look, we can't let these people frame things in such a way that we are siding with one or the other enemy camp. We should be always cleaving to our own interests in this.
I mean, one of the things to touch on the right here on this subject is that there's, in Britain, you will have a lead. I mean, you've got a few, we've mentioned people like Douglas Murray. There's another one of them that comes to mind is Lawrence Fox, who's a kind of a populist figure from a well-known thespian family, Edward and James. And he has his own political party called the Reclaim Party. And he went along last week and pulled all of the Palestinian banners off the cenotaph. He wants to be there as a kind of representation of Britain, which is fine. But what I'd like to see, to get back on the more Machiavellian thing here, was that if he had the sense to look at what it is that he actually represents in truth, because even if it's unstated, and he's a civic nationalist, he's a classic liberal and all of this, What he is actually a representation of the native white population of Britain, which is why he gets so much flack, because the enemy, the left, they understand what it is that he represents. And he's not the only one. There's a few others, but they're all kind of useless. They don't want to acknowledge it. They'll disown it straight away. But if he was to own that, and he's very well spoken, as I say, he's from a well-to-do upper class family. So what would be interesting in that scenario is when you have a look at the pieces on the chessboard, then these kind of people can say, when they understand that their Zionist friends who are powerful have got a bit of a problem on their hands, what they actually do is just jump straight in and fall and sort of fall over themselves to show their allegiance and show their loyalty and do whatever they want. And that is more often manifesting in sort of coming out and calling for deportations, asking why this or that Muslim group are in London, why are they in our country? So it's getting more and more in that direction. But what I'd like to see is that if they just held out a little bit, you know, if they were a bit more prudish, like a more interesting girl, he'd take out, and you've got to work on it a little bit, play a little bit hard to get. See, yes, what's on offer. See what's on offer. You know, don't just take your bra off. As soon as the Israeli lobby gives you the smallest of wink and you're topless and running around in your tights, like actually hold off a little bit, see what you can get, see what concessions they're willing to put on the table. This is the way that the Tory party in particular operates in Britain, because they stab the natives in the back. Immigration only ever goes up. There's more hate speech laws. There's all the rest of it. And then when it comes to election time, there's this phrase where they threw out red meat. They threw out red meat, and it's some policies, proposals, which seem kind of right-wing. They seem kind of nationalistic, but nothing ever comes of it. But what we're seeing getting slapped onto the table here, it really is a big chunks of red steak, because powerful players within the establishment have got a real headache on their hands. And so there's a lot of really juicy red meat being put out. And I'd like to see these people hold off a little bit. This isn't really our business. It's far away. What else are you offering? Put something more on the table. And also, I want to see actual policies here. You know, instead what they do is just jump in straight away to show their allegiance.
Yeah, one of the things that's been most educational about this is to see the absolute obsequiousness of the political establishment. And again, they're way out ahead of the public, and they're not very mindful of how weird they look, how out of tune they look. And of course, this is especially the case looking at the American Republican presidential contenders. It's just despicable. It's wonderful just to have clips of all of these people giving these doe-eyed blowjobs to the Israelis at every possible juncture. I think it's self-refuting at this point. But again, they can't help themselves. They're in the political class. But yeah, it would be nice if some of these people would play a bit hard to get with the Israeli Jewish interest lobbies. Sweeten the pot a bit. Put more on the table. We want to see a lot more before we're going to get on board with what you say. Let's actually bring in Carl Thorburn. Carl, welcome to the show. You've been patient. I'm sorry. We've gotten past the midpoint. How are you? And welcome.
Hey, I'm good. Can you hear me?
Yeah. You're loud and clear.
Okay, good. No, it's been a great discussion so far. I've enjoyed listening in. Thanks for having me on.
What are your thoughts? Do you think Jewish power is peaking?
I've said for several years now that I think feminism is peaking. I said it in 2014, and I think maybe it's possible that Jewish power is peaking. I was thinking earlier, you know, I've been watching some movies recently, and I was thinking earlier about Jewish power in Hollywood in particular. And, you know, it occurred to me that a lot of the reason that some of the best movies that have ever come out of Hollywood came out in the 90s was because Hollywood was still primarily staffed, I think, by whites. You know, obviously Jews were still in charge back then, but Steven Spielberg and other Jewish directors had the benefit of whites working underneath them artistically and things like that. And I think the sort of the same thing as we're seeing the same rollover occurring now in the broader economy is that as non-whites take jobs that whites once held, for instance, in the news media and, you know, finance and things like that, and even in politics, you know, with the rise of like the Indian class, Jews are no longer able to sort of direct things as well as they could in the 90s. And so they're starting to kind of lose their managerial abilities are kind of limited now because they're, you know, instead of directing white men, they're basically bossing around obese women and non-whites. And it's not nearly as effective. But, you know, also like you were just talking earlier about how we've kind of reached kind of a tipping point where the biggest cheerleaders for Israel right now are frankly cringe. You've got like Nikki Haley is honestly, I think the Jews would get more out of her if she would just shut up and recede into the background because she's just such an awful advocate for them. But, you know, I guess that's her whole job, is just to shift the Overton window. It's not really to win an election. It's just she's simply there to try to shift it in favor of Israel. But it's not working as far as I'm concerned. But yeah, I think, you know, and then there was a recent interview, I think, with Henry Kissinger. And I think he said something along the lines of that if he had not been born Jewish, he would have been an anti-Semite, which I found that to be fascinating. I mean, that was a huge admission from a guy who's approaching 100 years old. I mean,
I believe that quotation's from decades ago, isn't it?
Oh, really? Okay, well, I wasn't aware. But yeah, he was interviewed recently on the subject, and he was pretty conciliatory toward, we'll say, the Palestinian side, and sort of, you know, he was essentially much less gung-ho for Israel than you would expect.
Well, the thing that he said that I thought was most useful was just to say, look, multiculturalism hasn't worked out very well for Jews, and we're seeing this. One thing that Morgoth mentioned earlier was the counter-jihad movement. And the counter-jihad movement, of course, basically was like conservatives in the sense that conservatives, mainstream conservatives, want to try and do things. Sometimes they want to try and do things that are good for white people, but they have to make sure that they never actually say that this is good for white people. And so what they'll try and do is find a way that they can sell this as something that's good for the other. And especially in the case of the counter-jihad movement, it was an attempt to get a consensus together to keep Muslims out of Europe by talking about how dangerous these are to our Jewish friends. And the assumption of this movement, I thought, was extremely naive, because they would constantly harp on all the harm that Muslims were doing to random Jews in Western countries, thinking that Jewish solidarity would dictate a change of policy, not understanding that Jewish policy is made all the time in full awareness that some of these policies will cause terrorism against Jews and Jewish casualties. But they undertake these policies because they think it's in their collective interest. And in the case of supporting massive non-white immigration into white countries, the Jewish leaders think that those policies are on balance so good for them that they are willing to tolerate the occasional Jew being killed by these interlopers. And the people in the counter-jihad movement were just so naive. They just didn't understand that. And I stopped paying attention to them after a while. A lot of them went and hid after Breivik. That was a very long time ago. That's like a decade ago. It's gone very quiet. But now it seems like some of their arguments are finally breaking through. Now it seems like the stuff that they were hoping the establishment would support, namely stopping the immigration of these people and even reversing it because of the danger they pose to Jews, is actually happening. There has been a falling out between diaspora Jews and diaspora Muslims. And I do think that that's a positive thing. And yeah, none of us were particularly thrilled about counter-jihad because it never went far enough. But it does seem that those arguments have hung around and they finally hit home. They finally found a receptive audience after the Gaza crisis started. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, one thing I find the most depressing is like with these rallies in support of Palestine and then the counter rallies in support of Israel, is that it's basically like a conflict that's been imported into our countries. In an ideal world, I don't think that any country in Europe or North America should care less about. I think that they should, that there's no reason that they should care at all about what goes on in Gaza or in Israel, because it's this imported problem. It's a problem that's been imported by having all of these foreigners in our countries. You know, I think Morgoth will probably have a lot to say about this, but I'm seeing on Twitter and on Telegram that there's this planned pro-Gaza, pro-Palestine rally scheduled for Remembrance Day, November 11th. And it's like this big lose-lose, because either, like from the perspective of the native Brits, either you don't do anything and then you have this big
show of force of a bunch of Muslims in London, or you end up going out there, like the bulldog nationalism, as Morgoth would call it, that you end up going out there and going to bat implicitly in some ways, perhaps even explicitly in others, for Israel and for Jewish power. So it's just this back and forth of who can support foreigners more. And, you know, it's really this kind of dilemma that we really need to get out of, because it's awful.
I mean, there was a thing took place over the last week, funny enough, but I've got a feeling it was planned before that, with Jordan Peterson. I think Douglas Murray was there. Maybe Ben Shapiro showed up. But then there was also a lot of these newer kind of, I don't know, sort of classic liberals. I guess you'd call them, in our circles, a lot of people call them schizos. But they are against the World Economic Forum. They're against the COVID vaccines very much. They're against Agenda 2030 and all of these kinds of technocratic things. And I find it interesting that there's been this alignment where you've got that is now kind of linking up with not so much the counter jihad of the old days, because I think that is kind of done. They're trying to rejuvenate it and push it out again, but the base of popular support will be this sort of swelling, sort of huge swathe of people who are sick and tired of all of these very intrusive technocratic policies. But it's wider than that, you know, especially with the climate change stuff and the World Health Organization and all of these things which are kind of pushing their way into our lives. And I think it's interesting that this is now lining up with a much more pro-Zionist sort of push in opposition to the woke agenda, in opposition to all of that kind of thing. So they had a big shindig this week. But I have a feeling that it was a little bit, I have a feeling that it was a bit premature, that they, or maybe it was a rushed thing. I didn't look into it. But my impression was that they got caught out by this latest thing in the Middle East.
It's interesting. Is anybody naive enough to think that by supporting Jewish power, they're going to get less technocracy and less censorship? That does seem like an extraordinarily naive assumption. I hope these schizos aren't literally crazy, because they'd have to be literally crazy to believe something like that. Folks, we have more than 400 people in the audience today, which is wonderful. Well, welcome all of you. Friedrich writes in with $10. Greetings. I'm thinking that the non-white bodies have been one of the most potent weapons employed against us since 1945. Do you think the recent talk about deportations has any chance to materialize? Deportations will also increase the number of Muslims in the vicinity of Israel too. Cheers. Well, I think we've discussed that adequately. I do think there is a possibility that this will happen. And just talking about it and getting it into mainstream conversation increases that possibility. And so I do think that just by getting this more mainstream, that has increased the possibility of it actually happening. But we've got a long way to go. Another thing I need to say is that even though I do think that it's possible that Jewish power is peaking, it is absolutely solid in the highest levels of government, as we've seen in the U.S. Congress, as we've seen from the administration and so forth. And given that, there is a very dangerous possibility that just as they did after September 11, 2001, managing to spin a terrorist attack that was largely done by Saudis under the auspices of a guy who's a Saudi living out in the boondocks of Afghanistan, they managed to turn that into the basis for a war against Saddam Hussein. Why? Was he involved? No, but he was a bigger enemy of Israel. So they managed to take a terrorist attack against the United States by a predominantly Saudi group and turn it into a war against a party that had nothing to do with it, but was an enemy of Israel. They can do that again. They've already gotten a resolution passed, very dangerous resolution, talking about Iran having weapons of mass destruction or being very close to it, and the United States will do anything to stop that. That's a very dangerous thing. They're rushing billions and more in aid to Israel, of course. They're passing out war guarantees. These are the kinds of things that can blunder us into world wars. So the fact that their power is peaking in the normie media realm, the receptivity of normies that we can measure in the media, does not mean that they don't have the power to plunge the world into another world war. But it might indicate that there's more possible resistance that could be ginned up against that. So let's see if there are any more questions that have come in. And are there any more, any thoughts on this? Are there any thoughts on the potentiality for a world war coming out of this?
When I was first joining in, I could have blathered on a bit more about the glass half empty perspective. And I do think that the United States government is part of that perspective, as we've seen with recent, $14.5 billion placed in the Israeli war chest. And all of these American politicians, most of them Republicans, but even a few Democrats, just saying some of the most psychopathic things, warmongering things, the likes of Lindsey Graham, Nikki Haley. And then there's also this other element, which is huge in the United States, and that is the Israel Jew worshiping evangelical Christian population. And they are completely taken over by this end times prophecy obsession. They truly are a death cult. They eagerly await the death of untold numbers of people and the destruction of the world, because that's the sign that Jesus is coming back. And you know, you can blame the Scofield Bible and all that stuff, but this actually goes back very far indeed, and into the very early days of Christianity, that there is this slavish devotion to the Jews. Salvation comes from the Jews is something that Paul said. You're a branch that's been grafted onto the root of the Jewish people, who are still, you know, God's chosen people. And I see this all the time on social media. There are these Christians who are just disturbingly devoted to Israel. And that goes all the way up to the upper echelons of American power. The new Speaker of the House, what's the first thing he does? The first thing he does is pass some sort of bill about Israel. And then the first people he addresses as the new Speaker of the House is the, what's the name of it? The Republican Jewish Caucus or something like that. And he specifically said in a speech, I wanted to make it clear to the world that you would be the first people I speak to as the new Speaker of the House. I mean, for the people on our side, I know this frustrates them to no end. But apart from that, apart from the people like us, there's this enormous population of Americans who lap that up. And some of them are really powerful, not just politicians too, but the pastors like John Hagee. These are influential people in the United States, and they are 100% all in with starting Armageddon, provoking Armageddon. They have this weird idea that they can, them and the Zionists over in Israel, they have this weird idea that they can sort of trick God into speeding up the apocalypse and the rapture, you know, do all these, if they do all these things, and they provoke all these wars and they get the temple built in time, the third temple, then they can speed up Yahweh's process here. But all the rest of us just have to die in the meantime. This is a huge problem, and I don't see it peaking. I don't see it waning. I see it gaining in strength, gaining in momentum. And so, yeah, I definitely think that these psychopaths could put us on the path to World War III, definitely.
There is something that's a bit consoling here, which is that these attitudes are largely confined to older people, but we also live under a gerontocracy where these old people have a huge amount of power. And so, yeah, their attitudes are increasingly out of touch with the broader population, but that doesn't matter. They still have the power to plunge the world into war and chaos. And we do have to fear that. If we can get through this particular crisis and wait another 20 years, biology has a solution to gerontocracy. It's called death, comes to us all. And there might be fewer and fewer of these people who are just itching for Armageddon. But that's a slow process. We just got to wait that out.
Should also be noted that inside of Israel, there's huge opposition to Netanyahu now. And I read recently that Biden privately spoke with Netanyahu about the possibility that his political days are numbered, just simply because so many Jewish people within Israel don't like him. And also, my understanding is that a lot of people in Israel are not nearly as nationalist as his Likud party anyway. So that's going for us also.
What I worry about more than the evangelicals in America is people who are sort of fully signed up to the what he calls the boomer truth regime, or the post-war narrative. And if you listen to somebody, the way that Douglas Murray speaks, it's just repulsive. He'll sit there with his carefully curated intonations. He knows exactly the way to inflect his voice and at the right time. And he'll kind of whisper it in this way that the Jews are scared. Or I got a telephone call from a Jewish friend in New York, and he said, "Is it still safe for Jews to go to London?" And then there's this kind of silence. There's this kind of deathly silence there. And the crowd are all like, "Oh, that's so awful." And then he's saying, "It made me ashamed." And it makes me want to puke. But the language that he's using is kind of coded with the Holocaust. He's deploying that. He knows what's going on in their minds. He knows the kind of references, the cultural references, without actually invoking it directly. He knows what buttons he's pushing. And this is kind of the classic liberal kind of scene. Even if they don't understand it, this is what it's all like. And when we were talking about the deportations, it's actually the Germans who've gone the furthest in what they've been talking about. And in this kind of crazy situation, it's the Germans who are now, the Chancellor, no less, I think, is now put on the table the idea of deporting people if they're anti-Semites. And I just think this is wild. So you've got this kind of new sort of 2023 book broken Germany, but where this time they're gonna put people back into the striped pajamas, they're gonna roll up the cattle trucks, but this time it's because they're anti-Semites, and they're gonna send them back to Turkey or to the Middle East or whatever. Like a complete inversion, which touches on what we were getting at earlier. So we're always in the shadow of World War II, even when people don't reference it directly, or I suspect in Germany they probably would carefully. It's always there. It's always, that's what fuels the counter jihad. That's what fuels the bulldog nationalism. That's going to be a riot next week in England, is because they link their symbols. They link Winston Churchill. They link the Union Jack, the soldiers who died in the wars, with the Holocaust, primarily because of Hollywood. This is what they're invoking. The sort of the dying embers of this as a cultural trope are now being, like, they're trying to warm it up. They're chucking a bit of coal on.
Yeah. The lesson of the Holocaust, and I wrote a piece called The Lesson of the Holocaust. The lesson of the Holocaust is that stateless peoples are easily subjected to genocide. We've learned the lesson of the Holocaust. That's why there's a state of Israel. They have their ethnostate, and their ethnostate has an enormous stockpile of nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons, all illegal, of course, but we understand we're not going to hold them to those standards. And so when they start passing around this, meme, this handwritten note, would you hide me? Like little Anne Frank, would you hide me? The proper answer to that is Jews don't have to worry about a Holocaust ever again. They have Israel. They have nukes. Stop this shameless emotional manipulation. You're one of the safest people on the planet. You're one of the most powerful groups on the planet. You're one of the most privileged groups on the planet, namely, surely the most privileged group on the planet, given the red carpet treatment they're getting right now. And you're pretending like you're victims. Just cut it out. Because it's white people who are now stateless in our own societies. And it's so obvious that we're stateless because of this crisis. Because, again, the British, the French, and the Germans are all talking about putting laws on the books against criticizing Jews and throwing their enemies out of the country, whereas Germans are not sacrosanct in Germany. And you can rise to the very top of German society by shitting over your fellow Germans. And it's the same in England. It's the same in France. White people are not sacrosanct in white societies, but Jews are. That's a scandal. And I think we can never pay enough attention to this. And they're so exposed now. This is such an opportunity.
So, in terms of what Morgoth was referring to, that Douglas Murray is invoking the Holocaust and that World War II kind of pervades the entire, you know, center-right, counter-jihad, Zionist chill sphere. I think that actually goes a lot deeper as well. And it even influences the other side. So I recently read an article from DW. It's that German news network. I can't remember what the actual full name is. But anyway, it was talking about the attitude of the German people towards Israel. And it had something like 60-something percent of the German population was opposed to the policies of Israel, that they thought that the policies towards Palestine were unjust. Now, the German government is just fully zogged, and they're 100% on the side of Israel. But according to this article, a large portion of the German population was sympathetic to the Palestinians. And it even said in the article that the quote was that, well, the lessons that they learned from World War II and from Hitler and Nazism and the Holocaust is why they're sympathetic to Palestinians. So what you see happening here is that there's kind of this conflict between the interpretation of World War II in that, talking about Jewish particularism, the Judaic interpretation of this. But then there's the fully universalist, not quite as cynical and a lot more naive interpretation, which is that it's that any form of inequality is wrong, that it's a lesson on why egalitarianism is important. And I think that there's a trap which a lot of guys on our side fall into, some more than others, but it's one that you have to avoid. And I think that the criticism of Jewish power and Zionism is very important, but it has to be with the correct presuppositions, because if your criticisms of Israel is that Israelis are racist, that they're oppressing the Palestinians, that it's a quote unquote apartheid state, and that they're being cruel to these poor brown people, the problem that you're running into here is that you're using egalitarian universalist values to criticize Israel. And that doesn't really help us, because all it does is really serve to reinforce this in the West. Because if this is your criticism of Israel, then it implies that white countries should also be egalitarian universalist countries for everyone. I think that it's important that the framing of the criticism of Israel is both the hypocrisy of the organized Jewish community in supporting policies for themselves in Israel, and then policies for white countries, and then also the undue influence that they have over our countries, that their feeling, sensibility, safety is so much more important than that of white people. But it's important to also say that, you know, perhaps we might not be as bloodthirsty as the Israelis, but ultimately we do want a society for us that is, it is an ethnostate. We want Western countries to be ethnostates for their native white populations, in the same way that Israel is an ethnostate for the Jews. And it's important not to attack Israel on those grounds, because you're kind of doing damage to yourself. And you know, I sometimes see our guys falling into that trap, and it's something that needs to be avoided.
I think that's a good point. Hinchfoot has sent $5. Question to Morgoth: how would you answer your X poll?
I actually struggled with it. So I begin, I mean, this goes way back. I would, because I understand the ideological ramifications of it. I actually clicked yes on the Telegram one when I saw that everybody was clicking no. So if I begin my sort of worldview in what is best for the people around me, then right now it is that the northeast of England is being inundated with people from that part of the world. And so in the here and now of making sure that my family can walk the street safely, I'd have to pick yes. But at the same time, I understand that that's a short-term fix. And what I'm suspicious of is when people put ideology before core ideals. I think that trips people up. And so when it comes down to it, I will just look at the real-world ramifications of can an English girl in Burnley walk down the streets more safely because half of the town has been deported because they were anti-Semitic or something like that. I don't believe that would actually happen. This is purely hypothetical. It's a sort of a thought experiment. And in that scenario, then I would be forced to say yes, even though I'm well aware that what it does is reaffirm the kind of special status of Jews in the country. It's a deliberately designed, awkward question because I like to sort of toss that in from time to time. So just in the purely pragmatic stuff about can English girls walk the streets safely, I'd have to push yes. But I would do it through gritted teeth and fully knowing the larger ramifications of what I was doing. As I said, it is a sort of big lie.
Yeah, I would say, just let me jump in real quick and say, I think that I really don't mind Jews having a special status in Western nations. I think simply because, you know, when there's certain laws that are written specifically to protect Jews, as long as they're not materially or significantly impeding on, you know, pro-white movements, they're good because we can point to them as examples of Jewish power. So it's just not to me, for the most part, it's not an issue.
I think that's a good point. It's not so much it's not so much establishing that Jews are sacrosanct. It's revealing that truth that's already there. And so in a way, you can say, not only would it be a benefit for these people to leave, but it would also be a benefit because it reveals something that's already in place very clearly, namely that our countries are run for their interests, not ours. And that's an important lesson that we want to teach too. So we have a couple other questions here. Media Markt Verkaufer has donated one diamond. How do Jews like Friedrich August von Hayek, who fought for Austria-Hungary in World War I, fit into the narrative that they all act in concert? I have good news for you. Friedrich Hayek wasn't Jewish. However, if you want to use an example of a Jew who did fought for Austria-Hungary in the First World War, well, there were many of them. Hayek was a cousin by marriage to the Wittgenstein family, the philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein. His brother, Paul Wittgenstein. Paul Wittgenstein was a concert pianist who went off in World War I and lost an arm. And of course, there were other Jews who fought for the Second Reich and who fought for the Austro-Hungarian Empire. But the broader point is that we don't have to argue that they all act in concert. In fact, I am always acknowledging the existence. Another premise that we could question is, was fighting for the Central Powers in the First World War a good thing anyway? But let's leave that aside, right? I'm glad to acknowledge that there are good Jews. I know some of them. I just wish there were more. And sadly, there just aren't enough to avoid the terrible conflicts that exist when even a small number of Jews have access to the levers of power in white societies. And so we don't have to make airtight generalizations that they're all out to get us. They're not all out to get us. Sadly, however, they're not enough of the ones with conscience. They're not enough of the ones that are on our side to avert this terrible disaster that's unfolding. So those are my thoughts on it. So Hayek wasn't Jewish, though. He was a German and Slovak in his descent, not Jewish, as I understand. So folks, let's go back to this question and talk about how our guys are doing on Twitter. One of the reasons why I invited all of you on this show is because I think all of you are doing amazing work on Twitter and other social media platforms, commenting on what's happening here. I think the messaging is great. I'm seeing a lot of these ideas spreading about. I feel like some of the old magic is back from 2015, 2016. I think we're getting some good memes. I think we're getting some nice, how to put it, cross-pollination. And there's some camaraderie here in the trenches. So what are your thoughts on how this is going, the pushback from our circles?
One of the things that I quite enjoy is that in the sort of 2016 years, we still had an element of the Wild West. And I think in the years start beginning, especially when the censorship really began kicking in, it was painful. But people learned to use things and frame things in a certain way, which wouldn't just straight away set off all the alarm bells. If you go back to 2016, Twitter was awash in happy merchant memes, which you tend not to see so much anymore. And so what it is that we've refined ourselves through a painful process of being stuck on Telegram for years and being, everybody's being censored all of the times. And so you have to kind of put things in a certain way, which will not be obviously inflammatory and offensive. It used to be the case where you would be, largely because of the influence of the Daily Stormer, the idea would be that you would be as offensive as possible to blow up political correctness. And that kind of resulted in us getting blown up instead. And it's when you sort of raise the bar a little bit to how you put things that everybody gets it now. Anyway, I mean, I do think this is a terrible thing. Is that we've kind of learned to swim in censorship in a way. We know how to use coded language, and everybody knows the normie or the center normie. They know what it is that we're saying, but they can't actually get you on it because you've put it in a certain gentler way. You view it as a coded language that you don't get bank rights for it. And so yeah, I think it's a refined product that we're pushing out there now.
Pox, you've been great on Douglas Murray and a whole range of other people. What are your thoughts on the pushback that our people are producing?
Yeah, it's always nice to see it. I have such a long and love-hate relationship with Twitter, so much so that I even wrote an essay about it, because I have been banned from that platform more times than I can remember. I literally don't remember how many times I've had to make a new account. And when Elon was gifting everyone their accounts back, well, not everyone, but a lot of people, it was recommended to me that I try and, appeal and see what happens. And it worked. I got my account back. And something was up with the algorithm, because I went from having, my couple hundred followers, because again, I was always having to create new accounts with new names. And I went from having just a couple hundred followers to suddenly having a couple thousand. There was all this engagement and it was fun. And then of course, at the same time, lots of our fellow travelers and good friends were also being reinstated. It was like a graveyard had come alive with all of these dead spirits, and it was very fun and it was very exciting. And there was, suddenly all of these liberal journalists and all of the anti-white talking points, they were just getting ratioed, and the pushback was phenomenal. I think, those of us who had been exiled to the harsh lands like Telegram and Gab, we had really become ferocious warriors. And now we are returning back to this, land of milk and honey, where these soft, civilized people are living in decadence, and we come back like a horde of barbarians. And it was great. And then, of course, that account got banned as well, because I it was the funniest thing. All I said was something like, Hitler wasn't evil, in response to a Jew named Dan Krasenstein. I can't, there's two of them. They're twins, identical twins. But that was apparently too much. And so that account got banned as well. And then, you know, I was just thinking, well, I kind of am annoyed. Usually I don't mind, you know, getting kicked off Twitter. It's like, whatever, I don't really care. I know that any of these platforms could ban me at any moment. But I just felt very annoyed about it, because I did have the sense that there was a missed opportunity, and that because there's a bit more transparency, there's a bit more freedom of expression on that platform, and it's still, despite all of its, you know, problems or bad press that is being manufactured about it, it's still a very popular platform. And so I just felt like, no, it's a missed opportunity, so I'll sneak back in. And yeah, I think that responding to people like Douglas Murray is important. Responding to people like Gad Saad is important. And yeah, I see a lot of positive things. Again, Twitter is not real life. X is not real life. But when you see others too, like Adam Green, for example, or what Keith Woods has been doing, and the Twitter spaces they're having, there's different features now on X, I suppose is the proper name, that are really conducive to amplifying the engagement and, you know, red pilling more people, which has its merit. It's not the end all and be all, but it does have its merit. And things like the Twitter spaces, and you can see the engagements that a tweet or a thread or a post gets. And yeah, it's quite astonishing at some points. Obviously, it's not as good as it could be. And again, it is not real life. So like I said earlier, I think we need to really be focused on real influence and how to make a real difference in actual politics, not just ratioing shitlibs. But it's still good that happens. So I think that definitely. And what Morgoth said earlier about giving credit to even those who have small accounts, and I'll include myself in that. I've never had anything more than a few thousand followers. The work that they do, just jumping in and leaving that one criticism or that one meme or that one fact that really throws a spanner in the works of whatever the narrative was in that journalist's tweet or that politician's tweet, it's effective. It goes back to another thing too that Guido Tajetti and I talked about, and he wrote about in his book, using the political witchcraft, which is social media, and causing problems for the establishment rather than trying to solve problems. And we are all part of this sort of guerrilla army. Mm-hmm. And that's true for the person who has, you know, 500,000 followers and a really important account and, you know, blue check and all that. It's true for the real life activist. And then also there is the third ring, third hierarchy, is the sort of, I guess, the foot soldiers, which is all of us who take the message and run with it and spread it everywhere possible. And yeah, disrupting the narrative, mockery, making people look bad, embarrassing them, all of that is great to see.
Carl, you have been a Twitter bad boy for years, and you have great Twitter game. How is it being back in the arena?
Oh, yeah. I think I'm on account number 6 now. But I was just going to add, you know, I really think that AI art has been a huge boon for the right. And I think it's only going to get better as time goes on. I think that over the next few years, it's just going to become so much more detailed and more beautiful. You know, I was talking to a friend the other day. I think my Twitter timeline is like 10 times more beautiful than it was before AI art. And I anticipated this because I think people on the right aren't as artistically gifted as people on the left. You know, artists generally, visual artists anyway, are sort of tend to be left leaning. And so I think that as time goes on, our guys are going to be creating some just really incredible, not just art, but also political cartoons using AI. And these are very valuable because they stick in the mind much more than text does. So I'm pretty optimistic about, it's just so much more fun. Social media is way more fun with AI art.
Well, I guess I'll jump in then with my, on Twitter. So I actually took about a year's break from Twitter voluntarily. I'm still on my first account that I've ever made. I've never been banned from the platform, but I found that about a year ago, actually maybe about a year and a half ago at this point, I really kind of just got sick of the platform. It just felt like it was us arguing amongst ourselves. You know, it would be, well, who's more base, the Orthodox guys or the pagans or whatever. And it just seemed like it was just nonsense. I just had enough of it. But that, I feel like Twitter, since the Musk takeover, let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. A lot of people still haven't been reinstated. And it's not the Wild West of free speech. However, it does feel like things are actually happening there again, and things that aren't just like pointless internet arguments. I know it's all stuff on the internet, like Pox pointed out, that it's not real life, but it feels like there's actually a real conversation going on. Just look at someone like Musk himself. Now, I'll be the first person to tell you that he's not our guy. He's not on board with all of our ideas, but even the fact that he'll actually engage with our ideas. So he might not fully embrace them, but the fact that he can even, like, he'll reply to someone like Keith Woods. He might retweet someone like Keith Woods. And the fact that the richest man in the world is engaging with our ideas as if they're actually something that needs to be taken seriously in the political realm, that's a pretty big gain for us because, you know, years ago, you wouldn't have gotten that. You never would have gotten any kind of interaction by anyone who had any amount of clout in the real world with our ideas. And then, you know, what you see with people like kind of the shills who we've been talking about throughout the evening, Douglas Murray, Peterson, it does seem like we've kind of gotten the better of them in many ways. Now, they're still more influential. They still have their huge followings, but they're not in a position where our ideas can just be ignored now. So someone like Peterson has basically gone insane trying to refute us. Like if you remember about a year ago, he was going on these rants about how anonymity online should be abolished and about how we were all these demon monsters and stuff like that. You know, the fact that the broader political discourse, that our ideas are really kind of seeping into that and people like Elon Musk are interacting with it, I think it's very encouraging. And I actually have kind of, I told myself a year ago I was never coming back to Twitter because I hated the site, but I've actually kind of enjoyed it. I've been able to keep it under control and actually have some fun. What I've been doing is I've been messing with PragerU and these kind of accounts. So like they've been doing this thing where they'll say like, is something, something blank, like fill in the sentence. Like one of them they had was, if you're not for blank, you're not a conservative. And I put, if you're not for white ethno states, you're not a conservative. And of all the replies I looked at, I think that my reply got the most interaction. It got more likes than the initial tweet itself. So, you know, it seems like our ideas are really kind of seeping in. So I am happy about that. I know Twitter is not the be all and end all, like Pox said, but well, it's a lot more pleasant than it was. And it's also a lot more pleasant than us arguing amongst ourselves on Telegram. So in that case, I feel positively.
Yeah, I still have not gotten my New Right America Twitter account back. I had more than 25,000 followers on there. Not huge, but it was something, especially given the fact that I didn't even use the account for the first maybe 5 years of its existence. It was just set up to automatically tweet out whatever I posted in the Countercurrents Facebook group. And so when I actually went and looked at the Twitter account, there were thousands of tweets that were just things that had been published over a few years, just announcements from Countercurrents. But then I started getting into it. And of course, I said things that got me banned more than 2 years ago for replying to some douchebag who says, there's no reason you need an AR-15 by posting things about the extremely handy uses of an AR-15 when Antifa are trying to kill you. For instance, as that young lad in Wisconsin, Kyle Rittenhouse, showed us. So anyways, I'm sure some Antifa got really steamed about that and started flagging it, and my account was taken down. I have tried three times now. I've appealed it three times and I've gotten nothing. But I was just chatting about this today with Matt Parrott, and he said, I set up a reminder to appeal once a month. And finally, after a few months, I got my account back. But it took a number of attempts. So if you are one of the people who hasn't gotten your account back, just keep appealing, because it might just happen. So I've put in my third appeal, I think, now to get my original account back. There is nothing on that account that compares to some of the shit that was on, I don't know, maybe Andrew Anglin's account, for instance, that got reinstated. So I honestly think that I need to be brought back. I want my free speech back on Twitter, damn it, because it looks like all of you guys are having quite a lot of fun. I want to start replying to GadSad and people like that, and have 25,000 followers to look at that. So we'll see if it happens. There are some other questions here. Okay. Russia Boy has sent in $1 on Odyssey. Dr. Johnson, what's your thoughts on people who claim that Jews are naturally more intelligent if white nationalists assume different races varying cognitive ability? People could argue this. There are a couple thoughts on this. And if the rest of you guys want to chime in on this, we can end on this. If Jews are more intelligent on average than white people, that's all well and good. If that's true, I don't have any objections to those facts. I know that Asians are on average more intelligent than white people as well. However, if people are going to argue that Jews are really intelligent and hardworking, and that's why they're running your societies according to their interests and their fancies, and in some cases running your societies into the ground, I'm sorry, I get off there. I do not believe in some kind of disembodied meritocracy where you have a society that's run like a company, for instance, where your company wants to hire the best people and it doesn't matter what country they come from, as long as they're the smartest. That's no way to run a society. I do not want to be ruled by clever aliens, even if they say it's for my own good. I'm sorry. I want to be ruled by people who are my kith and kin, who share my culture, share my language, and share my values. And that's where I really find people like Jordan Peterson and others who go around talking about, oh, Jews are very, very smart. That's why they should run our societies. No, sorry. That's where I get off. If Jews are smarter than average, then they should be able to go to Israel and make Israel work without billions of dollars of subventions from the United States and other countries, and without being constantly on the brink of war with their neighbors. If they're so smart, they can figure this out for themselves, and they don't need us, and we don't need them. So those are my thoughts. Morgoth, do you have any thoughts on the Jewish superior intelligence claim?
Yeah, I don't see much evidence of it. I'm willing to accept that they've got higher average IQs, but I always go back to the sort of the Hollywood situation, because you'll see that so many of the directors in Hollywood movies are Jewish, and they're not that great. If you look at them and they've got, I don't know the exact numbers, let's say 125, 135, whatever it is as an average, in America, you'd still have millions upon millions of more Europeans with an IQ which was higher than that. So if you look at something like Hollywood, it would still be dominated by Europeans. You would still have more David Leans than Jar Jar Abrams. And so I can't help but think of all of the David Lean movies, so all of the European directors that we didn't get because of the nepotism in Hollywood. And in my view, that's what it comes down to. I don't see that much evidence that there's that so much great stuff to be done by that high IQ. Because you would still have more intelligent Europeans. So it's nepotism at the end of the day.
Exactly. And Ron Unz did a very good article about Jewish overrepresentation, even factoring in the IQ differences in the Ivy Leagues. And of course, the answer is that they're massively overrepresented because of nepotism, not because of merit. Endeavor, do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, I think that pretty much covers it. That's pretty much my position, that I think that they might have a higher IQ on average, but I think that the overrepresentation is definitely because of nepotism. So, and then I would say that in response to what some people might say about this being why they're important or why they're successful, I think it's more important to have people who are loyal to you than necessarily have a higher IQ, because, you know, somebody can be a genius, but a genius can use their intelligence for evil. So, you know, even if it is true, I mean, I think that the big problem with them is the conflict of interest, not necessarily the IQ difference.
Yeah, let me just say real quick, Greg, you brought up meritocracy. You know, we already have meritocracies. They're corporations for the most part are meritocratic, and corporations and businesses fail all the time, right? They don't last forever. So if you want to run a country purely on meritocracy, it's going to fail eventually, right? It's going to fall apart.
That's actually a very interesting and good point. I need to think about that more. There's something fragile about the pure meritocracy compared to a community that's based on kinship and common history. Pox, what are your thoughts?
Well, speaking about my articles for Countercurrents and Substack, I actually wrote about this very topic just last month. And interestingly enough, it was about the CEO of Library Incorporated, which at one point, I believe they split, but was the progenitor of the very platform that we're on tonight, Odyssey. His name is Jeremy Kaufman. And on several occasions, but on a recent occasion, he returned to this thing of Jewish IQ, and he was on X posting about how there is no conspiracy. Jews do run the world, but it's not a conspiracy. It's not hard to explain, because Jews are really intelligent and have a really high IQ. And then he made some really foul posts that didn't sit well with me at all. And so I kind of just dismantled, in particular, two angles that I did not approve of. One is this hypocrisy, again, talking about Jews and hypocrisy, around the very idea of IQ. In fact, on X, I just posted a thread taking down Douglas Murray, which is really doing numbers, if I do say so myself. It seems to have proven very popular. But it's a series of clips from an interview that Douglas Murray did with Jordan Peterson in 2018. And at one moment, Douglas Murray, using that soft, concerned tone that Morgoth was talking about, he says that when the topic of IQ comes up, he feels very uncomfortable. Those are his words, very uncomfortable, because it just instantly calls to mind catastrophic potentials, this cliff that we could all fall off of towards Nazism if we give too much importance or credence to IQ. And then, of course, I think we all are aware of the fact that anytime you talk about IQ from a European nationalist perspective, from an anti-immigration perspective, by saying, you know, we have first world societies run by and populated by people with an average of 120 IQ, we cannot import unlimited numbers of people with a 65, 70, 80, 85 IQ. Although I think 65 is like gorilla, so maybe not that low is, well, I don't know. And so then in response to that, you'll usually get this claim that IQ isn't even a real science. It's white supremacist nonsense. There's no real way of judging IQ. There's different kinds of intelligences, et cetera, et cetera. And if you're concerned about IQ, you're probably a racist and a Nazi, so we're going to shut you down. But when a Jew like Jeremy Kaufman talks about IQ and how Jews have so much of it, there's no longer that taboo. That problem is just completely disappeared. And so it's interesting that Jews can talk proudly of their high IQ, but when white people do it, we are, again, sinning. We are sinning against the woke tenets of the modern world. And then, more importantly, what I found distasteful or just annoyingly hypocritical about this is, let's all agree then that IQ is real and that Jews have a very high one, in particular Ashkenazi Jews. And then let's even agree that that's the reason why they have so much power and influence. Let's say that it's only 30% nepotism, and all the rest is their wonderful IQ and their brilliant competitiveness. Okay, great. Because again, Jeremy Kaufman was proudly saying, yeah, we do run the banks, we do run Hollywood, we do run the world. I think even I said, we do run the world, but it's not a conspiracy and it's not difficult to explain. It's because we have high IQs. Okay, let's all agree. Then at what point do they take any responsibility for the way things are going and the way things have been going? At what point then? If we're all going to agree, okay, Jeremy Kaufman, you're right. IQ is real. Jews, Ashkenazi Jews in particular, have a very high one. And that's why you run the world. When are you going to then take responsibility and accountability for the way things are? Right? With great power comes great responsibility. You've got the power. Where's the responsibility? Because I was under the impression that when Wall Street shenanigans, when financiers on Wall Street cause an economic crisis, it would be an anti-Semitic trope to say it's the Jews on Wall Street's fault.
I hate to interrupt if I could, but this is very reminiscent of what's happened with Sam Bankman-Fried. His defense was ignorance, and he was I believe a Stanford graduate or an MIT graduate actually. And it's like, how can you claim ignorance when you're 140 IQ?
Yeah. Or even again, like, Margot mentioned Hollywood. Yeah. Okay. So Joel Klein wrote in the Los Angeles Times a few years back, who runs Hollywood? Come on. It's the Jews was the title of his article. And there's been other moments where frustrated Jews or proud Jews just come out and say, look, can we just stop beating around the bush? We run Hollywood. We run it. It's fine to say it. And so again, okay. Jews run Hollywood. Let's agree. And let's agree that they run it because they're really smart and artistic and clever. Okay. Are you going to take any responsibility then for the moral cesspit that it has become? Are you going to take any responsibility for the several years now that we've been having just awful, awful films? Where do you take responsibility for that? America's foreign policy. We look at the State Department, full of Jews and full of dual citizens. Okay. So if we are fed up with America's wars and we want peace in the world and we don't want to be teetering constantly on the edge of the Third World War, at what point then do Ashkenazi Jews take any responsibility for this? They always play the victim and then they brag about how clever they are. If you catch them out, they'll either, like I said, they'll call you a racist for focusing on IQ and things like that. But then many of them will say openly, yeah, we have high IQs, and that's why we have all this influence. Okay, fine. But then take some fucking responsibility, too.
That's beautifully said. One of the comments from Hinchfoot is very amusing. He says, with small hats comes no responsibility. Thank you very much. I like that.
can I get the final point in about Douglas Murray just before we wrap up? Because I remember the clip. This was the sort of the alt-right era, the meme wars. He was saying he was going along to meetings and people were standing up and they were asking him things about Jewish influence and about a race and about IQ. And he says, it makes me feel uncomfortable. And it's and with this kind of dark foreboding. And I'm sorry, but he presents himself as this classic liberal or conservative, this classic English conservative figure who draws on those values in opposition to the craziness of the modern world. But the problem is, an actual classic liberal of English liberal of the era, which he tries to evoke, they would have been very, very comfortable talking about race and IQ. They would have talked race and IQ all day long. So really, Douglas Murray, what he represents is just an earlier phase of the woke craziness that he railed against.
That's well said. Well, folks, this has been great. Thank you again for this very, very good panel. And we will be back a week from today with another episode of Countercurrents Radio. Until then, we're just going to be watching and eagerly rubbing our hands together at all the amazing news that's taking place. So thanks, and we'll be back next week.